Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When it was launched 30 years ago, the Hubble Space Telescope was set to revolutionize our understanding of the universe. Free from the distortion of Earth's atmosphere, the Hubble would bring astronomical objects into striking focus and enable us to peer farther than ever into the cosmos. But there was a glitch. The images were blurry. Luckily, the Hubble was important for another reason. It was designed and built to be repaired. Catherine Sullivan, the first American woman to walk in space, has written a new book about the Hubble and her work with the space shuttle crew that launched and later repaired the Hubble. The book is titled Handprints on Hubble, An Astronaut's Story of Invention. Catherine Sullivan, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks, Anne. Glad to be here.
There's the Hubble, and then there's the Hubble that was built to be maintained, to be fixed. Why is that significant?
Well, the original motivation, of course, had a little bit to do with politics and bureaucracy. It was going to be expensive to build a telescope and put it above Earth's atmosphere. People started thinking about that in the 1940s, before there even was a space program. So to get the astronomers to believe this would be worth doing, NASA had to be able to commit to them. This will not be like a telescope that a few scientists get to use. This will be like the telescope we build on top of a mountain for years on end. One group of scientists after another will be able to go up there. You can swap instruments. You can improve it. It can evolve with the science. So it'll be an observatory, not just a telescope. So that really required that NASA make that commitment and get the design engineers thinking incredibly far into the future about, wait, how do you actually set up the architecture of a telescope that's the size of a school bus? None of us have ever built something that big before, and make sure that astronauts in bulky Michelin man suits can actually repair and upgrade it for a couple of decades.
I'm thinking about your checklists, and I know you were in charge of the checklist. Most people, the biggest checklist they'll ever get is when they buy a new home and they go through and they check off that list. But what are we talking about in terms of the things you had to check to make it ready to be repairable?
Oh, goodness. Hundreds, if not thousands, of particular things, down to truly every single bolt that fastened every single electronics box into the telescope. Does it really fit with the tools that we had built? If it fits at room temperature when you're testing it on the ground, will that all still fit when it's on the sunlit side of the Earth and it's heating up towards hundreds of degrees, or when you're on the dark side of the Earth and it's cooling down? Wild swings of temperature when a spacecraft goes around the Earth every 90 minutes. So we had to really think about every fastener and every cable and every box. Does each tool work? Can human beings in bulky suits really reach it? Did you ever put a wrench on a bolt and find you only had about a half an inch to swing the wrench?
Right.
We need to make sure we don't have any of those cases. And a point about checklist, in the work we did on the ground before we put Hubble into orbit, we weren't really working through a checklist. We were kind of working through an inventory of all the things that needed to be checked. The crews that actually went up starting in 1993 to do the repairs, they were working from step-by-step checklists for how to do the repair. But the thing that a lot of people miss is those astronauts and the engineers that they were working with, they wrote those books. So this is not like I got the owner's manual from my car and I'm trying to read it and remember it. You wrote this checklist. You started with blank sheets of papers. Wait, how do you do this on a Hubble? Well, let's write it down. And then let's go check the steps we wrote down and see if they work. It's a little more like a conductor or composer conducting her own symphony than a student proving on a test that they remember something in a textbook.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Catherine Sullivan. She's the first American woman to walk in space. She's author of a new book. It's titled Handprints on Hubble, An Astronaut's Story of Invention. That's because she was on the crew, the space shuttle crew that launched the Hubble into space. It was in 1990, right?
1990.
Yeah.
But sadly, never on one of the crews that repaired it. So.
Right.
But we laid the groundwork for that, and then we had to watch enviously as others went about the fun spacewalks.
You mentioned that, the envy, in a gentle way, throughout the book, whenever another crew took off on another mission and you weren't on it, and you said everyone felt the same way, but you played it close to the vest.
Yeah, we sort of played it close
just
to the
natural.
Vest. And we joked, sure. I mean, I list in the book what we always called the five rules of spaceflight. You know, there's no such thing as a bad spaceflight. Flying sooner is better than later. A long flight's better than shorter, and so on and so on. And the final rule was, when in doubt, refer to rule one. There's no such thing as a bad spaceflight. Anyone you get is a great one. But we're all eager, curious, ambitious people. You'd be happy to be on every flight. It's just, that's not going to happen. But, oh, that's such a cool mission. I wish I was there.
The politics, I was kind of interested in the whole politics of that and how people are chosen and how different assignments you get give you clues to what they might be thinking. But the whole process is very military-like. It's just you're told what you're going to do.
Yeah, I would just call it opaque.
I mean,
it was, we had a key manager at a senior level, a guy named George Abbey, who I talk about a fair bit in the book, who was renowned for playing things, for being very inscrutable, and sort of managing by clique, seemed to always have a little band of favorites who would be his go-to people for key assignments or key tasks. Some of my colleagues sort of tried to play in a way to get into George's little cadre. Others of us just said, you know, I'm going to live my life and we'll figure out, see what happens. But yeah, it was all kind of opaque. You know, why have you chosen somebody rather than another? I think your choice is kind of where do you largely just trust decent judgment is being applied, plus or minus whatever bits of favoritism might enter in. I can look at my assignments, my first one and my third one, were scientific missions that were highly centered on a lot of complex earth science studies. And at the time, I was the only credentialed earth scientist in the office. So it made sense. It was gratifying to me. It was probably gratifying to the investigators on whose behalf I was working that their proxy on the space shuttle deeply understood their science and would have some sympathy for it.
You know, I didn't know whether you went on the repair mission when I started reading the book. And I kept hoping you did. But then it became clear to me that once you get an mission assignment, that's usually 2 years in advance. I mean, these things, so you spend a lot of time preparing for one mission, and they just don't go, oh, you know what, I'm going to change my mind, let's put Kathy Sullivan on it instead.
Yeah, it's a long runway. I mean, it's, you know, the five to seven people on a space shuttle are the only 5 to 7 people on scene. They don't need to know how to do everything, how to run everything, how to fix everything, how to keep it all going. So the depth of knowledge that you dig in to build on the space shuttle itself, but also on all the equipment that you're carrying along, it's intense. It's fun to get to dive that deeply into things and master something that thoroughly. But you're right. You don't get there in a week. So you take
so
a long.
So you know when they say you're going to go, you know, you're going in 1988, you know, whatever year it is, you know, well, that's it. I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's not a chance.
In early shuttle days, there was a certain category of missions that were deploying communication satellites. Those had enough commonality from one flight to another that there would be a little more flexibility to say, we'll pluck Anne off this one and put her on that one if it was the same kind of a satellite deployment. But these intense scientific things like my Earth science missions or Hubble really needed at least two or three of the crew members to dive very deep for a long time. It's very much the same with space station nowadays. Folks who are lined up for these expeditions are spending several years getting really thoroughly, deeply into the science, the instrumentation, the spacewalking stuff that may come up during their 6-month stint.
It was interesting to read that when you first started thinking about a career, you're thinking like State Department. And being in the diplomatic corps or something like that, I kind of smiled because I thought maybe you're glad right now that you did. That's a little more complicated than it maybe seemed. But you were pursuing foreign language study as prepare for that, and then you took a left turn.
Yeah, you know, I was basically looking for a path through life where someone would buy me airplane tickets and I would get to go have grand adventures. And my discovery around age 10 that I've got a flair for foreign languages, that started the first theory. You know, learn a lot of them and somehow that will turn into this adventurous life. What do you know about careers at age 10 to 12? So a glimpse of foreign service through Michener's caravans.
Yeah.
Somebody must be translating, interpreting for people. It's a pretty naive theory. But it was enough to raise my sights and give me a commitment to doing well in school because good grades and great talents in languages somehow will create me these opportunities. That was as far as I could see, but it turns out that's far enough to see.
Mm-hmm. Because you got to college and they said, well, you got to do some science.
Yep, mandatory.
Which you thought was kind of ridiculous at the time. So did I, by the way. But I didn't vault to the NASA program eventually.
I had studied the course catalog at college. I kind of had mapped out what I wanted to take, and there was no room in my game plan for three science classes my freshman year. And I mustered every argument and just about to the level of tantrums and tears to try to get myself out of it, and failed happily. I failed.
Yeah.
And that's when I discovered, this thing called Earth Sciences, geology, oceanography, they're actually way better tickets to the world than the languages are.
And I'm thinking, wow, you were an oceanographer. You had a PhD by the time you were 26 years old. You could have gone great places in that direction as well, but it was your brother, was it not, who suggested that you apply for this opportunity with NASA?
Yeah, my brother's the lifelong flying nut in the family. I'm a more varied explorer. And over a Christmas break, he had already thrown his hat in the ring for the astronaut selection. He started elbowing me over Christmas break that I should do the same. I'm still thinking, I'm trying to understand the geology of the deep sea floor about 12,000 feet below sea level. That's hard enough, and you now want me to go 200 miles further up? That's insane. That's mm-hmm. nuts. But a little later, back at grad school, when I thought a bit more, I realized that's the wrong way to think about this. This is not go on a shuttle to continue being an oceanographer. This is about becoming an expedition manager on a new class of research vessel called a space shuttle. And I loved going out to sea. The planning, the preparation, the at-sea operation of oceanographic cruises, they're slow-speed space missions in a sense.
Yeah, sure.
So it was a great practice ground in a lot of ways for what NASA was looking for. And it was my favorite part of oceanography, was the operational part of doing the cruises and expeditions. So when that light bulb went on, then I filled out the form and threw it in.
Along with thousands of other people.
Something just shy of 10,000 other people.
Oh my gosh. And there were about 200 were selected for a next stage interview, was that?
Yeah. At that stage, what NASA would do was, cut down by looking at references and your track record on paper. They'd winnow down to a couple hundred to bring to Houston for a week-long battery of interviews and medical exams, things like that. And then from that, they would choose the final selectees. So we went from, I think it was something like 8,700 wannabes to 200 prospects to 35 astronauts.
Wow. And there was something they said, tell us a bit about yourself. And they said, start with high school. You did that. But then they gave you an assignment after the interview and said, write one page about why you want to be an astronaut, kind of a thing.
Yeah, actually, the first night we were down there, the sort of introductory familiarization night, they informed us that we had to come to our interview. It was either bring it to the interview or turn it in the next day. I forget, so long ago. But in no more than a page. And none of us had computers or typewriters, so this I probably think we all did it longhand on the hotel stationery,
right.
Probably. Write a page, no more. But it really, deliberately unstructured. Write down why you want to do this, not more than a page. So, if you could do it in a sentence, just that deliberately not clear, fully clear instructions.
What are they looking for? What's your
sense
about
looking
that?
For how do you respond? This is a high-stakes situation, not life and death, but there's something really valued you care about. High-stakes situation, you really want to perform. Everyone would love certainty. If I do A, B, C, and D, your life turns out the way I want it. We're looking for people that we're going to send into settings where you're not always going to have that certainty. No syllabus, no particular guidelines. Unexpected things will happen. And how do you conduct yourself in those cases? Do you make some sense of it and keep going? Do you halt and sort of paralyze until it gets clear? There is make a decision in life, and then not making a decision is a decision in itself. So I think they're just also in that open-ended question at the start of the interview. Tell us about yourself. Start from high school. I had never met any of these people. How would you know what they want? What is the right answer? Well, you're not going to know in advance what the right answer is. So how are you going to handle that? Do you remain composed? Can you make some sense? Can you stay coherent? Do you structure? Can they see you've constructed some pathway forward, and they're looking for that kind of resourcefulness and, I guess, a degree of internal confidence in, I'll keep moving and I'll keep trying, as opposed to, I'm stuck.
And then, you know, when people find out I'm going to interview you, they say, oh, I remember when I wanted to be an astronaut. You didn't grow up wanting to be an astronaut or anything close to it. Do you think that was an advantage emotionally at a certain point when you got to that level of, yeah, you got the interviews and now you're just going to go home and finish up your PhD or whatever you were working on and then wait for the answer? Or by then, did you say, no, I really want to do this now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I certainly grew up watching and admiring and really being enthralled by the adventurousness, the challenge, the skill, and the adventurousness of what I saw the astronauts doing. And some part of me felt a real empathy to that, sort of resonated with that. That's the kind of person I want to be. That's the kind of life I want. But, and maybe this is just me, and maybe it's kind of typical of young girls, we're not kind of raised to always have the quick answer of what job do you want? You know, have a title, have a label. I want to be a fireman or an astronaut or this or that. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, I did want to be an astronaut because I wanted that kind of life.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm watching Jacques Cousteau. I'm seeing that in a couple other places. So for me, it was, I really do know what I hope my life can turn out to be. And I got some ideas about how to do my part of making that. And, you know, then it was kind of at different junctures after high school or college, scanning my horizon and deciding that looks like the next best avenue towards what I'm after or this. So when this prospect popped up, you know, I had a history to know this is kind of where a lot of this happens. I would say when I went down for that interview week, I'd been living in Canada for the better part of four or five years at that point in grad school. And I remember walking into this room full of 19 other wannabes that night, or prospects that night. And there were clusters. They all seemed to know each other. There were several that were, you know, knew each other from military assignments. I didn't know anybody. And I remember my first thought was along the lines of, I don't know how you got here, but enjoy this week because these guys seem to actually know what's going on. And I, you know, you have no clue what's going on. But as I went home at the end of the week, I was equally clear that I knew a couple things. I knew I'm confident I can do this job, and I'm confident I would love this job. I want this job. And I have no idea where I stand in the 200 they're looking at. So I've got a 1 in 200 chance-ish, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
My guest is Catherine Sullivan. She's the first American woman to walk in space and author of a new book. It's called Handprints on Hubble, An Astronaut Story of Invention. If you have a question for Catherine Sullivan, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Former NASA astronaut Catherine Sullivan was the first American woman to walk in space. She was part of the space shuttle crew that launched the Hubble Space Telescope. She's written a new book about her role in making that happen. It's titled Handprints on Hubble, An Astronaut Story of Invention. If you have a question for Kathy Sullivan, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's something you said. You wrote it in the prologue of the book, and you made similar references elsewhere in the book about how you felt at home in space. And what do you mean by that? I was intrigued by that because you made several references to it. And this is, again, someone who had been an oceanographer, so I kind of get the parallels there, but what made you feel at home in space?
Well, I think what I was referring to there is on my second, and it happened again on my third flight. I mean, living and working in zero gravity is such a wildly different thing than the way we spend most of our lives.
Right.
You know, your cup sits on a table, your gravity is all around you. And to get so comfortable in that zero gravity environment that the second time, third time you go there, even if those are years apart, as they were for me, as soon as the spacecraft engine shut off and you're in microgravity again, it just right away felt so natural to be back in that environment, which just always struck me as amusing because it is such an extraordinarily crazy, wild, weird environment.
It couldn't be more foreign.
It couldn't be crazier. It's like, you know, it's like the every sci-fi movie you ever saw, and suddenly you're living in it, and it's natural to be there. And it just, you instinctively know, your muscles remember how little effort it's going to take to do something compared to what it used to take you to do that on Earth. And you, the first time you do it, you can watch people sort of, if you know what to look for, you watch them on video, you can tell their body and their brain and their muscles are learning how to tamp down and go slower and smoother motions. You can see them being a little wild for a day or two.
Uh-huh.
And then all that sort of drops away into a sort of graceful elegance that becomes natural to working in zero gravity.
Is it as fun as it looks?
Microgravity is super fun. It is absolutely super fun. Yeah.
It just looks like fun. Yeah. And a lot of the science fiction movies I've seen, you see people rolling around and it just looks like a blast.
It's very, you know, you can play Superman and float from wall to wall.
Yeah.
I joke often, this is the one environment in which I know my mother would not have been mad at me for playing with my food, because you can have a lot of fun with clouds of M&Ms and, you know, schools of goldfish crackers. It's good fun.
You were among the first, well, your whole class that year of 35 was unique, or the first time there were women. There were six women, and also the first African-American astronauts.
And first Asian-American.
And first Asian-American, right. And it was the first, I guess, a way to summarize, the first not all-white male class. And that was significant at the time, obviously, but it also attracted a lot of attention from the media in a different kind of a way. And you talked about that in the book, but I was wondering, what did they ask you? Did they ask you any stupid questions? You were the women and the African Americans, and I guess the Asian American astronaut, but you were all in high demand at that time.
Yeah, we really were. My three African-American classmates and our Asian-American were all male, and they were all military officers. Mm-hmm. So they were a little more like astronauts people had seen before. Women was this altogether different thing. And you know,
That implied a lot of different things. Yeah.
It implied a lot of different things. You know, going into confined environments, working in close quarters. So I think every imaginable dimension of fear, prediction, stereotype, you know, was sort of swirling around in people's minds. And, you know, I think the peskiest question, and the one that on occasion got under my skin, was sort of, male astronauts have been able to do everything from flying to the moon to doing the spacewalks to doing the science. You know, why are we adding you? I mean, astronauts are also competent. Aren't you guys going to just go along and watch? I mean, won't the pilots?
Why?
Why do we why do we need you? Why do we need you? And are you sure you can do this kind of thing? But the other was, you know, what are you going to do? The space shuttle is kind of small. Are you going to have enough privacy? Well, are they going to have enough privacy? I mean, it was just all that kind of for you. Where are you going to go to the bathroom? Which was always what I encountered going out into geology field camps, or, you know, resistance to going out on oceanographic ships somehow always came back to, we can't take you along because we don't know where you'll go to the bathroom. I said, well, in the bathroom as well, or behind that tree. And that's not your problem. Just why is this an issue?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing.
And are you going to have makeup? And, yeah, it was all
the usual hairdos and the whole thing.
How are you going to continue to fulfill my stereotypical view of what a sweet young woman should be when you're doing all this, you know, macho astronaut stuff, I think was the essence of it.
Mm-hmm. Was it irritating, or just you were ready for it?
Well, we the six of us were certainly, we were all newbies to media attention. So what we do was sort of...
And it was international.
It was a bit, but it was really predominantly American. But okay. it was kind of thrown into the deep end of the pool with respect to the media, with no formal media training, a couple of pointers from one or two key people. I think we were just composed enough and maybe snarky enough to hold our ground and push back.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Catherine Sullivan, the first American woman to walk in space, author of a new book. It's titled Handprints on Hubble, an astronaut story of invention. She wrote about Hubble because she was on the space shuttle crew that launched the Hubble telescope in 1990. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Mark in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I have two quick questions. It's my understanding the problem with the original telescope was a mathematical conversion problem, and the mirrors weren't ground properly. I wish you'd elaborate on that, if that's so or if that's wrong, please. The other thing is I've always wondered, things that go up come down, if the Hubble precesses, is there anything on board to... rockets or retros or whatever to boost it to a higher orbit? And is that being anticipated? Because I think that the lifespan has already exceeded maybe what people expected, and I hope it goes on. So thank you for answers to both of those.
Thanks, Mark. Great questions. I'll take them the other way around. Hubble's orbit decays like any spacecraft does. It's in a good stable orbit now, very high. It does not have any propulsion aboard, not retro rockets or maneuvering rockets. But the final servicing mission did attach a gadget to the back end of it that would allow a robotic space tug, and those do exist now, would allow a robotic space tug to go up and grab hold and slow Hubble down enough that you could predict where it would reenter the atmosphere and break apart and drop into the ocean. The chunks that would be likely to survive the fiery reentry burns would probably be the two large chunks of glass, mainly the primary mirror. The flaw with the primary mirror came about, it was just ground to the wrong shape, and they used two devices to measure the shape and check whether it was correct. And in a nutshell, they used a sort of modern laser method and older style method. The older method said it's not right, and the newer method said, yes, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And they were very under the gun, behind schedule, over budget, under a lot of pressure. Rather than doing the smart thing of disassemble both devices, put new teams on, remake the measurements, because there's one mirror, you should get one answer, not two answers. They talked themselves into picking the answer that said you can proceed. And so they are off by like 1/50th of the diameter of a human hair at the outside. So it was not a metric conversion error. It was assembling the measurement device incorrectly.
Thank you, Mark, for the call. We appreciate it. What was that? Well, before that happened, and I want to talk about the repair, there was the tragedy that delayed the mission.
The loss of Challenger.
The loss of Challenger, and at least in our generation, I think everybody knows where they were that day. I was in a newsroom, at a newspaper, of course, and I think we were running around. It was around a holiday, I can't remember.
January 28th, after the New Year.
It just felt like that everything changed, because after Challenger, everything changed when it blew up that way. And you wrote about that in the book, what it was like to be on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, it was an absolutely horrible day. It was the loss of seven people, five career astronauts that I'd known for years, four of them my classmates, two folks who were along for that particular mission. So sort of, wrong lottery ticket kind of happenstance, but still, nonetheless, seven lives lost. That's bad enough. And then, of course, all of us that are part of the program, it really was sort of like being catapulted off a cliff into free fall. What happens now? What consequence does this have to NASA as a whole, to the space shuttle program, to whatever flights you're working on individually? Sort of all comes to a screeching halt and goes blank in some big, vague unknownness that lasted for months. How does this start up again? Where does it start up? How does it start up? How do we get back? Where does this all go? And as intensively as you're always working on flights, we were Hubble, the deployment mission, we thought we were 9 months from launch.
Yeah, what was it was originally supposed to launch?
October of 86.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're 9 months to launch. Things are funneling down and intensifying rapidly to get through final launch preps. And suddenly, like I said, it's like suddenly your car went off a cliff and you're just suspended in ambiguity. So hugely painfully sad and hugely ambiguous, uncomfortable unknowns that all lasted for a very long time.
When you launched the Hubble, was that the first time? When was the first time they went up again in a space shuttle after the Challenger?
That was STS-26 in September of 1988.
Okay.
So we were, you know, Hubble was a thing unto itself. So yeah. As NASA reviewed, you know, when we get back to flying, what is the priority for what flies first and second and third, a number of cargoes moved ahead of us in line because they had particular time factors attached to them. Hubble, good news and bad news, Hubble did not have a time factor attached to it that really staked it to, you know, must launch by this date.
Yeah.
So we became one of the few flexible elements that could move around at will, which if you got to set up that schedule, you want one or two of those things that you can slide around however you need to. If you're the crew on that flight, you don't want to be slid around everywhere.
Right.
You want to go.
I think about the Challenger tragedy. Yeah, there's human lives lost. Then there was the impact on the program writ large, I guess. The same thing sort of happened when the Hubble went up and they found out that the telescope, the lens was wrong. It was a humiliation in a way for the whole program. And I'm wondering what that feels like when you're part of this huge team of people. And what, do you go out and kick a car fender? I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, I think we probably all wailed at the moon yeah. several evenings in that time frame. Yeah, the loss of Challenger was, you know, clearly technical failure that called the technical basis for flying a shuttle into question. Is it you?
Okay.
You got to now go through every nut and bolt and bit and piece and re-satisfy yourselves with more rigor that we know what the risk level is, we know what the safety margins are, and we're managing them correctly, because clearly Challenger showed you'd been wrong about those. All three of those you'd been wrong about. You can't do that in spaceflight. Hubble was more, let me put it this way. Challenger was a deep injury, a deep wound. Hubble was a huge insult. So it called into question the technical competency, but without the tragic and
yeah.
crazy costly consequences. But it again implied, you guys can't actually do this as precisely as you need to do it to succeed in spaceflight. And because the two incidents were not really that far apart, 1986 to 1990,
yeah.
there kind of still was a bit of that cloud, and both technically and politically, it became easy to again call all of NASA into question.
But then, because of the way it was designed, you could fix it. And that was a whole nother thing. We have to take a break right now, but that's kind of the linchpin here, that pretty immediately you can prove.
There's the pre-planning part to that story, and there's the flash of insight in a shower, which maybe we'll talk about.
Yes, we'll talk about when we come back. We'll talk about rescuing the Hubble with my guest, Catherine Sullivan. She's the first American woman to walk in space and was on the crew that launched the Hubble telescope. She's the author of a new book. It's titled Handprints on Hubble, An Astronaut's Story of Invention. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking today with former NASA astronaut Catherine Sullivan. She was the first American woman to walk in space. She flew on the space shuttle mission to launch the Hubble Space Telescope. Her new book is titled Handprints on Hubble, An Astronaut's Story of Invention. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Okay, when we last left our conversation, we had just launched the Hubble, and not long after figured out that there was something wrong with the lens. You weren't part of the mission to repair it, but you were part of the mission that made Hubble what it was, which was repairable.
Right, and the secret to fixing, resolving the problem with the mirror is an 8-foot diameter mirror that's a little too flat at the outer edge by about a 50th of a human hair.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And it's now 334 miles above the Earth, doing 17,500 miles an hour. So how do you fix that? And there's two prongs to the answer. One is, the first prong is you don't fix it. You fix it by rephrasing the problem. I'm not going to fix the mirror. I can't fix the mirror. You screwed it up. But the good news is you screwed it up quite precisely. So like your eye doctor can calculate what lens will turn your eyeball into a good eyeball, the mathematicians could calculate precisely what kind of correction would turn the bad light bouncing off that mirror into the good light it should have been. And so they could calculate it. They used mirrors instead of lenses, but they could make that calculation. Now your trick is, okay, how do I get those mirrors into the light path? So I can, light comes in the front of the telescope, it hits the bad mirror, it's warped a little bit, it bounces off another mirror, and it goes down into the instruments. How do I get my corrective mirrors into that light path so I can turn bad light into good light? And that's where both the design for maintainability and an engineer's flash of insight come into play. There's four refrigerator-sized scientific instruments at the very back end of Hubble. They stick into that light path. They have to, because they, you know, got to get the light in there. Take one of them out. In its place, put exactly the same size box with these mirrors inside of it that will pop out into that light path. How did someone think about that? Really, truly, an engineer named Jim Crocker is in one of these brainstorming sessions in Holland where everyone's tearing their hair out trying to figure out what the heck do we do here. He goes in the shower in the morning. This European-style shower that the shower head can move up and down and pivot and tilt. Mm-hmm. He's pretty tall. He had to move it above his head and twist it a little bit, and the light bulb went on. We have a box that sticks all the way into the light path. We could put a rod like this at the inner corner of that box, and we could have it run up, out, and just like the shower head can pop into position, we could put those mirrors on little arms that pop into position. So that's what happened on the first repair mission.
It wasn't really a repair. It was an adaptation in a way, right?
It was an adaptation. And over the years after that, as each scientific instrument was upgraded to the next model after, they would build the correction into each one. So that first box called COSTAR that worked the magic, that's now actually on display at the Air and Space Museum in Washington.
And was it different because of the way it was designed to be maintained, since that wasn't originally part of the design? How did they approach it that way?
Well, needing to do that particular fix was never
anticipated.
But what was anticipated is all these major scientific instruments, from year to year, the scientific objectives of the telescope will change. Technology will improve, detectors and electronics. So we're going to want to be able to take these refrigerator-sized boxes out and put new ones in, exactly the same shape, but totally different innards. That was in the plan, to be able to swap refrigerators, if you will, with different things inside them as the science evolved. So when it turned out the science has not evolved, but you have a technical problem you didn't encounter or didn't anticipate, you could use that ability to swap out these refrigerator-sized boxes as a platform, a pathway to solve that problem.
It's the first thing that was designed to, it's evolved in space. It's more than what it was when it went up there.
I won't defend this number, but I would say it's at least about 1,000 times better telescope now than when we put it into space in 1990. Because over the years, you could take out the old camera or the old spectrograph and put one in that had, you know, a decades better technology, a decades better sensor and detector and solid state electronics to replace electronic components that would have failed and broken, better solar arrays. The solar arrays are something like a third smaller than they were when we put them up there, but they generate 20% more power. So more efficiency, more reliability, better scientific capability. I think there's four things that are the same. There's six things that are the same on Hubble when we put it up. The two mirrors, the structure that holds the two mirrors, that's three. Two high-gain antennas that send data back and forth, and the outer skin. And virtually everything else, every other instrument, everything else that makes Hubble work and be what it is, has all been upgraded, 30 years worth of upgrades.
You include a Time magazine cover, I think it is. I think they call it the $1.5 billion blunder.
I think it was Newsweek, but yeah.
Newsweek, okay. Yeah. And neither of them are out there anymore. And I thought about a couple things about that. Immediately by then, I thought, yes, but they can fix it. And number two, it only cost $1.5 billion. That seems cheap now.
I'm not sure where they got that number from, but I'll give them that one.
Back in the day, I guess it seemed like a lot of money. And
and of course, it was larger than the number originally promised when. Yeah. When the commitment to actually build the telescope was sort of the first stage commitment was made in 1973, and the real okay green light go ahead was 1978. So 1990 is many years later, and the dollar number had gone well north of what the first promise was.
After all of that, you went up again one more time, right?
Yes.
That was your last time?
It turned out to be my last time, yeah.
And then I'm wondering what life after that is like.
Continued exploration.
Yeah.
There are a lot of good.
That's how you approach it, right?
Absolutely. I will never do anything in my life probably that will get the kind of headlines that my space flights got me. And I didn't do that for the sake of headlines.
Right.
But that kind of public renown and visibility, I'm sure I will never have again in my life. But that's not. That doesn't mean there's nothing of similar worth and value and satisfaction to do. And there's a lot to do. There's help moving, designing organizations, making organizations run right.
Which you said is something you like to do.
I like to do that. And the creativity of hands-on education, the kind of stuff that happens at places like COSI and
where
other science museums.
President and CEO, right?
Yeah. So I've loved that stuff. It's just it's not going to be front page stuff like my space flights, but... Boy, it's just been a great ride all the way along.
You settled in Columbus?
I migrated to Columbus, recruited out to run the old COSI and build the new building and, bring all that together so that it worked. And, I'd been to Ohio once before, and my baby astronaut year visiting what was then the Glenn Research Center up in Cleveland.
Right.
I grew up in Southern California, so prior to that, I would be one of those people to kind of say, Ohio?
Fly over.
Fly over, But yeah, it's grown on me. It's a great place to live. It's a wonderful community to be a part of and contribute to. And I don't think you can pry me out of here now.
You, president and CEO of COSI here in Columbus, director of OSU's Patel Center for Mathematics and Science Education Policy. President George W. Bush appointed you to the National Science Board in 2004. You eventually served under President Obama as Undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere, kind of getting you back to a little bit of your roots, and then Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Your tenure ended in 2017. Did you want to continue on?
No, I was asked to go back to NOAA in 2010 by a colleague and friend who then was the head of NOAA. I went back as her deputy for a couple years. And I made that decision thinking this is a 24 to 36 month fun experience, help her out with some problems to solve, and then I'll be ready to come home. I got more interested in the issues facing NOAA and was happy when the White House asked me to stay on and serve as the administrator. But 7 years was more than twice as long as I had planned on.
Yeah.
Bouncing back and forth, I kept my house. I was going to come home regardless of the outcome of the elections. I was ready to move back.
What do you think about this idea of a space force and kind of changing sort of the tilt by which we see space exploration in the United States?
It's an idea that's been evolving for a number of years. It's not actually particular or originated
new.
By the...
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the way I think about it is it's akin to when, if you think back to World War II, we had an Army Air Corps. It was a part of the Army that dealt with airplanes and how to use them effectively in military issues and campaigns. And at some point, aviation matures to the stage that you really need to develop a cadre of people, of experts who grow up and are deeply inured in how to do the best of everything with airplanes. So you separated an Air Force from the Army Air Corps. Space is now both so hotly contested and a competitive environment among countries, commercially and otherwise. And it is of such pervasive importance to both our society and our military. The time has come, and this is really the fundamental purpose behind Space Force, the time has come to establish a cadre where you can really develop deeply skilled space professionals and have them serving at the ranks of Joint Chiefs of Staff, so they're actually shaping strategy and policy for the long haul as well as doing the day-to-day. So I think it's in the right direction. It's time to give it its own body of expertise and get the depth of experience and skill that we need for spacefarers.
I think about, you know, the Hubble and how long ago, as you pointed out, you know, they kind of grew up with it. You were born about the same time, the idea of it. And how many years, I mean, people who thought of it in the first place and conceptualized it, they're not around anymore.
Yeah, the astronomer who's largely credited with really sparking the march towards Hubble, a guy named Lyman Spitzer, he was around to watch us launch it.
Okay, he was.
Yeah.
But not anymore. I mean,
no, that's right. Yeah.
That must have been something for him.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. Yeah, he was one of the very first space-based astronomers with much smaller instruments in the 60s, where everybody cut their teeth on how do you get anything into orbit and how do you make something work in outer space. And then to get to see this vision of a really large, powerful telescope that's an observatory, a multi-user observatory, not just my experiment.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you feel confident that we have enough people thinking that long term now?
I don't think you can ever have too many people looking at that far horizon and thinking about the longer term. And you just it's you can't ever see all the details, but to know there's a direction, to know there's something we need to be working on. And as the story of Hubble shows, the kind of effort it takes to bring other people along with you. You know, the only thing any of us really ever does truly alone is have the start of a good idea. And everything after that depends on being able to mobilize and bring together other people, other skills, other support to turn it into some kind of reality.
Do you ever watch science fiction movies or read science fiction?
It's not my favorite genre, but yeah, now and then.
That's what I hear often from scientists. It's just, you know, no. Why is it not your favorite? Because other people might think, well, wow, wouldn't you want to watch Contact?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just not the thing I turn to all the time. I think, I like to read. I love to read, but I tend to read things that help me think about, you know, how do people come together to make things happen. The good science fiction, I think Contact was good science fiction. I think The Martian was good.
Yeah.
I do like science fiction that shows a vision of a possibility that doesn't yet exist and then imagines what living in that arena with that capability would be like. That sort of inspires me to wonder the whys and why.
Because that's sort of what you did.
Yeah, yeah. Good science fiction authors are doing it on a much further horizon than my imagination tends to get to.
Well, Catherine Sullivan, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Catherine Sullivan, she's the first American woman to walk in space. She was part of the space shuttle crew that in 1990 launched the Hubble telescope. She is the author of a new book. It's titled Handprints on Hubble, An Astronaut's Story of Invention. Check it out. And thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.